eagle down to me, and he shook his head towards me with the eagle down to bless me. And it was so moving and so gentle, the love between Maikiel and her son and Tama and her daughter was so, so beautiful. It was so gentle. And those moments were also incredible to witness. These are some of the things that I wanted to say. I guess the last thing I'll say is I really deeply appreciate Thema's understanding of the complexities and dynamics of what it means to be Tahltan and to be Tahltan in this moment. And also to work with materials from her homelands, not only the bodies of the salmon and the bodies of the berries that she gathered, but also materials such as birch or willow. All of these she handled with deep care, and also like a real facility and capacity for how these materials work with one another. So I was going to answer the question, can you think of a time in your life in which giving played a role in your own development as well as the development of your community? And as I mentioned, my communities are reinvigorating our song and dance practices. Years ago, I lived in Treaty 6 territory in Alberta in Amiskwichi Waskahegan. Please forgive my pronunciation, as I'm not Cree. And in that context, I attended many giveaways within ceremonial spaces. I lived there for nearly a decade. I also participated in giveaways within round dances and at powwows, which are more public. Both of those are more public, although they have ceremonial components to them. And I noticed that there was this beautiful practice of composing songs regularly, making songs regularly. And so I decided to compose 6 songs in my language. I first started them in English, the lyrics, and then I worked with the Alutiiq Language Project in order to have the lyrics translated into Shukchestun, my ancestral language. I worked with the late Nikolokli, the late Sophie Kitelnikoff, and Florence Pesterkoff, as well as April Lactonin Counselor, in order to translate the songs. And then I worked with the native village of Afognak, with youth dancers to learn the songs and to choreograph to the songs. I think there were about 35 dancers in the program. And then we performed those publicly, and I gave those away to the community. And I didn't have a protocol for the giving, but I know that in order to, within these other structures or protocols, that you have to ask permission or you have to sort of acknowledge where songs come from. And so I wanted to give that to the community in order to have more songs to sing. Since then, of course, like many, this was in 2005, and many people were already composing songs. They've had song composition workshops as well. There's been a lot of work to compose songs in my language. And I think there's only been one song that the community has really taken up. Most of the songs, they didn't. And I just want to clarify, I would listen to the sounds of the language in order to find the melody. I was listening to the language in order to find the song. But I think that this was an important moment, at least particularly in my own development, and I hope in my community's development as well.
I just wanted to, in terms of my closing thoughts on Thema's work and exhibition, is again express my gratitude to her for bringing in to the gallery an artistic practice that literally we would not exist without, and that's our food sovereignty. It's the basis of our cultural practices. It's the basis of our health and well-being. It's our medicine, our nutrition, and that the ancient knowledge that goes into putting up fish, not only gathering and cleaning, but making jam as she did, gathering and cleaning berries, gathering the plants for teas, preparing tea, and then allowing for that tea to exist in its full form in the gallery. That when I teach Northwest Coast art history classes, I start with our food, because, you know, having grown up with aunties who had smokehouses going for 50 years in our community, specifically my Auntie Ruth Booth, that we wouldn't survive as a people without our foods. And when most people consider Northwest Coast art, they think immediately about our carvers. And then secondary are weavers, third are beaters. It's just been this long time sort of hierarchy that exists in the study. Never are our culinary artists considered. So for her to bring it into that space and to bring our food sovereignty forward without talking about our food sovereignty, her poem, like saying those words, her poem is that you've shared at the beginning, Christy, to me was about that embodied experience of bringing that knowledge into her life experience, into the life experience of her daughters and her daughter, to the shared experience between her and her aunties. That I don't know if I actually, I've been doing this since right out of high school, and I'm 42 now, and I don't think that I can't believe that I'm witnessing those practices brought into a gallery space within my lifetime. I didn't think this would happen. So it's just in thinking, having a historical consciousness around the way that Northwest Coast art and art history has developed since it first became its own studies in the 70s. This is a tremendously impactful and momentous exhibition that I really hope gets the attention and praise that it deserves beyond the moment of showing within the gallery space.
It's true. Thema actually chose, together with Haley, the image of the huckleberry hand stained as the image that will kind of represent this conversation when it's shared virtually later. So I think it's a very integral point. Alicia, is there anything you would like to add to those important closing thoughts from your perspective?
Yes. I think being able to have Thema down south, because I was currently going to school, I am going to school and living there, and then for her to be bringing pieces of back home down in that area, for myself being in that area, feeling disconnected from my own home and own culture, and not having like some of the similar either plants and medicines or even food down in the lower mainland. And I did not know what I was expecting when I was going there, but I walked away with so much more knowledge and so much more things to really think about that just would change my view of things. And to also be able to walk away with gifts that are like gold down south when I didn't have that resources like down there. And even just to have jarred fish is like complete gold like down there for me. And I wasn't like back home where I'm like, oh, I could just go and catch fish out of the river like I would usually do. And during the process of even the canning, it is a lot of work. And the stained fingers, and that really makes me think about, we are so abundant and rich in these areas, and it's such a blessing to be able to even come home and still connect to the land and still connect with the medicine and the food, and to be able to go hunting and things like that, and seeing familiar faces. So there's just so much there that is to consider that really gets me thinking like, oh my goodness, like, it is very beautiful to be able to have a home and call home, and yeah, just to give thanks for everything. It was such a great night, such a great experience, and I'm glad I've got to meet some of Thema's closest friends and colleagues and people who were able to be there and witness everything. Yeah, it was such a great, great night. I even actually did like an essay on her exhibition that was so inspired by it. And I'm hoping, I'm like, what can I do with this piece of cloth? Maybe make a bag or something, or use it in some way that will honor the experience. And also I can use it for an everyday thing. So I love the idea that you're going to make your boy pants out of the pieces. I'm really hoping I'd be able to put together a bag of some sort. Yeah. Thank you.
That's maybe all I'll share, but I just want to say, Koyana, for the opportunity to think alongside each of you. And I want to thank Thema for an incredible time that we spent together, you know, thinking with one another, being with one another. You know, Thema's work is really important. And I can only express a little bit how important it is. And in fact, I often think about how when we do an action, we don't understand like the fullness or the full impact of that action, that it actually takes time for it to sort of unfold over years. And so I wonder about that fullness and what that will be in the future, that was sort of set in motion by this exhibition and the preparation and also the performance and the action of giving away. I hope to make something with what Thema gave me. So maybe that's one of those future moments. But Koyana, thank you so much.
I agree wholeheartedly with you, Alicia, but coming from the same territory and being from the same tribe and feeling just so socially displaced, having to go to a city to get your degree, to go to university, to like not have those resources as close to home as one might like, and just feeling that loneliness and that alienation from everything that you know is a daunting experience. And I was so grateful to have Thema there with her exhibition, and she was hosting the exhibition at the school that I currently attend, so it just made like the whole campus feel like a more welcoming experience for me, that I knew there was a piece of home in there with me through my exams and through my loneliness. And to have those gifts as well at the end, really, it really meant a lot. It really felt like I was at home just for a little bit, even in the dead of winter and the loneliness of the urban jungle. So I was really grateful. I was unfortunate that I missed the ceremony itself, but I was really grateful to be a part of the preparations and to be a part of this witnessing interview today, and to be able to express how much it really meant to me and still means to me that I have someone like Thema in my life, and someone as intelligent, spiritual, and she's also the one who offered me this job and saw so much in me as an individual with potential, and like introducing me to my culture. I never really had that connection to my culture, though I did live up north and I was surrounded by it. I didn't really learn about the history and like had this drive to want to revitalize and to be an active participant in my community until Thema introduced me to these philosophies and her own work and how much she is accomplishing by taking pride in where she comes from. Truly inspiring, and I'm really grateful for it.
Thank you, Haley. I was just really honored to hear from all of you, and thank you, Haley, for writing our descriptions and guiding our conversation and creating those really rich and resonant questions that had so many different aspects to think through together. Thank you all.
So before we log off today, part ways, and return to the chaos of our daily lives, I want to take this moment to express gratitude for this meeting. I want to acknowledge the roles that we all play in not only witnessing, but breathing life into an experience and fulfilling the relationship between speaker and listener and host and visitor. I want to say Madhu, which is thank you in the Teltan language. Madhu to our witnesses and talented speakers. Tanya, who's not with us today, Alicia and Michael, thank you for sharing your thoughts and adding endless substance to this gathering. Madhu to Christy and Christopher for the time and energy you've extended towards the exhibition as well as this meeting. Your efforts do not go unnoticed. And finally, I want to say Madhu to Thema for her ongoing work in revitalizing Indigenous philosophies and specifically Tell 10 Ways of Knowing and Being. I also want to extend gratitude on her behalf to everyone who joined us here today to discuss her work and her art and the legacy that she is creating. Thank you so much.
Thank you all very much. It's been an honor to be a part of this conversation.
Yes, thank you so much. It was great meeting everyone and seeing familiar faces. And thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you all. I know that many people will experience Thema's art and all of your words through this conversation. And so it will travel to places where people weren't able to attend the exhibition. So really thank you for helping us to share it for Thema's family and friends in Tahltan territory and other places. Thank you.
That was witnessing Thema Igara's Hugadesk, giving it all away. That was a part of a two-part presentation. We've aired on the Tuesday Speak Up for the last couple of weeks. The speakers featured in the discussion were Tanya Lucan Linklater, Alicia Johnny Hawkins, and Mikkel D'Angeli. Speaking of a performance by artist Thema Igara's at the SFU Gallery in the fall of 2022 called Hujhadeskwelch. If you enjoyed that conversation and you want to hear the first part of it, you can find that on our website under the as a recorded program for Speak Up. It's probably still on the front page, but you might have to go and look through the schedule and look for the program that aired on December 12th, 2023. This program will also be posted up on the website later today, and you can listen to it again there. Thanks for listening. Here comes Bird Note. Drive on my
is bird note. Some birds are rare. Some birds are shy. Some birds dwell in remote, utterly inaccessible forests and swamps and deserts. Not the long-eared owl. Though it's hard to estimate the populations of nocturnal birds, there may be as many as 5 million long-eared owls in the world. They aren't particularly shy, and in many places they breed and winter right in towns and cities. And yet, even by owl standards, the long-eared owl is a rarely seen bird. Even if you're constantly on the lookout for this handsome mid-sized owl, it's a red-letter day when you actually get to see one. It's not a question of rarity, shyness, or inaccessibility. It's a combination of plumage and habits that makes the long-eared such a find. The mixture of warm browns and cool, bark-like grays lends the bird an astonishingly branch-like appearance. When people or other potential predators approach, long-eareds further enhance their invisibility by closing their orange eyes and stretching their bodies as close to the vertical as possible. Even to an extremely practiced human eye, they become nothing more than a jagged stump in the roost tree. Sometimes, just knowing they're out there, somewhere, has to be enough. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Daryl Travis's wife Jennifer loves Christmas lights, so each year he turns their Vancouver, Washington home into a holiday wonderland with light-up trees, candy canes, and snowflakes that flash and change colors to the beat of music.
And every year, she is always amazed about the new things that I add every year just to give it to her as a Christmas gift.
The display takes him months to plan, but it's cheap for him to operate because the couple has a 21-kilowatt solar array on their roof. Travis says for most of the year, the solar produces more energy than the couple uses, so he banks credits with the power company and then uses them to pay for the Christmas display. And he makes the display efficient by using LED lights and flashing them.
If you're blinking or flashing a light once a minute, then the rest of that minute, you're not using power and you're saving power.
Over time, his solar power display has become a local attraction. So although it was created for one person, it now brings joy to many more.
The fun part is standing outside, watching the people watch the display. I get to hear the oohs and ahs, and I get to see the just happiness it brings to everybody around me.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a safe and happy holiday season.